The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai. Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
An open letter from former Labour Party guru Fergus Finlay, who tells her that she has just got the most difficult job in Irish politics. Well, Joan Burton, congratulations and good morning.
Good morning and thank you very much.
Is it the most difficult job in Irish politics? Are you daunted?
Well, like all jobs that people look for, particularly in politics, you put your face on a poster. That's always the biggest shock, I think, when people first run for political office. You're walking down the street or driving your car and there you are in an 8x4 poster, and that's the first shock. So I asked for this job. I went around and I met the members of the Labour Party around the country and I asked them for the job. They've given me the job. I'm really honoured and delighted to be taking up the job. It's going to be a very tough job, but I'm entering into it, I hope, with, you know, a fair wind in terms of the support
matter?
And trust of the members. Yes, I mean, I have a photograph in my office, which was compiled about 10 years ago, of all of the women who have been public representatives, TDs and senators for the Labour Party. And I have it in a fairly prominent place just to say we've come this far, I've come this far, because obviously anyone who's elected, man or woman, represents whatever they bring. But certainly in the Labour Party, the Labour movement, you come as part of a tradition. And I'm very conscious that the first woman Labour TD was Maureen O'Carroll, the mother of all the O'Carrolls. And I suppose the one that would be best known nowadays is probably Brendan. And that was in the early 1950s, and she was elected and was from Curwen Street, or lived for a while in Curwen Street, where I grew up, and then subsequently the family went out to Finglas. I never knew her, but when one of her grandsons was researching her history a couple of years ago, I remember he showed me, you know, some of the absolutely fascinating background about her. And I remember at the end of the 1980s having conversations with Dick Spring, who was then the leader of the Labour Party and a great supporter of women in the party. There were no women TDs at that stage, or indeed senators. Evelyn Owens was a long-standing senator from a trade union background. And I remember there being real concern on the part of people like myself, and particularly on Dick's part, that we just didn't have any women. And a year or so later, he invited Mary Robinson to stand in 1990. On a Labour nomination. And 2 years later, people like myself and a whole wave of others got elected. So, you know, there are still not enough women in politics in Ireland, in my view. And certainly the feedback from women in the course of this contest, including people who wouldn't have anything as such to do with the Labour Party, has been really positive. And I think any advance for women is an advance, really, in a way, for potentially for all women.
Did you think about your mother, Bridie Burton? Did you think about how proud she would have been if she could have seen these pictures?
And my dad, John. And I suppose more than most people, I've had, if you like, a lot of different parents. You know,
because all the time this Labour leadership is going on, the whole mother and baby home row is going on. And of course,
me,
you were in a mother and baby home.
And well, I was in St. Patrick's Guild and I was in a place called Temple Hill, which is out in Black Rock. And yes, I was always aware growing up, to be honest, of how lucky and blessed I was. I mean, I had, you know, if you like, probably from a story point of view, if you like, not the most auspicious start. I've gone back and I've traced my birth family. I never met my birth mother. By the time I got successful on the tracing, she had died, and so had my father. But my phone has been buzzing with texts from relations, you know, all from the southeast mainly, just wishing me well yesterday. And that's really nice, because I think the thing for a lot of adopted people, your family is the family who adopt you. But you always want to know what's the story.
Yeah.
And lots of times as well, people want to know information in terms of medical backgrounds nowadays. So I must say, I've been very happy at being able to trace my own story. When I read Chum, I was, you know, it's not something I didn't know about because it was always spoken about when I was a child. My mother was a really friendly person, Bridie. She had a huge range of friends. Unfortunately, when I was in my teens, she became very ill and she died before I was 20. But she always believed in people and she believed in me. And she gave me that sense of do what you want to do. And she was a great backer of me.
She'd lose you though, wasn't she?
Yes. And that was always a fear because I didn't come to the Burtons until I was about 2.5. Because as I subsequently found out, and as she told me, I was meant to go to America.
You could have been Hillary Clinton.
well, I could have been involved in US politics. I had always been told that, but the way they used to put it in those days, that you weren't strong enough to do something. So I was pretty kind of miserably thin when I was a child. And in fact, when I went to the Burtons, they lived in Rialto Cottages. It's a very nice area of the South Circular Road, and the neighbours all took hands in feeding me because by all accounts I was a pretty reluctant eater, and the big fear was that social workers would come and would take you away, and that I think carried as a tradition for a long time, and she was always worried about something like that. But when I was about 4, 4.5, I was actually formally adopted, and of course then there was the security of that arrangement. So, you know, adoption's often talked about as a triangle. There's the person who's been adopted, there's the birth family, and particularly the birth mother. And one of the things that attracted me to the Labour Party, I have to say, years later when I was in my early 20s, was the fact that in the early 1970s, Frank Klusky and Brendan Corish, who was the leader of the Labour Party at the time, they were in health and social welfare, yeah, which was a joint ministry then. And they brought in legislation, and some of the titles in that legislation are pretty awful. The Prisoner's Wives Allowance, the Deserted Wives Allowance, the Unmarried Mother's Allowance, and basically for women who would be parenting on their own, and also for women alone. For instance, women who'd been minding parents, yeah, a lot of them on farms, they brought in allowances for women on their own. And essentially after that, that was around 1973-74, after that, women who had a child on their own and didn't have family or partner support, they could actually go and get a small income from the state. And from then on, women simply chose to keep their children, made great sacrifices
and
to do that.
And actually, I didn't mean
and
to get into
and
this
baby
to
let, homes, yeah. Actually, within about 5 years, not only had the numbers of children fallen dramatically,
right,
but essentially
it was a
they
huge
were on
change
their,
that
they
came
were on
about
their way
because
out
of those payments.
And that's an enormous
social advance. And what I want to ask you about is, from your point of view, as a woman, as somebody who joined the Labour Party inspired by that kind of vision, what it's like then to end up all these years later, you know, having to cut those allowances, having to cut child benefit. I know there are all kinds of reasons, and I know as a minister you have to say there are all kinds of reasons and overall it's good. But what does it feel like to have to do that?
Well, anything to do with the budget is a difficult decision, and I made a strategic choice in difficult circumstances to keep the core payments. But what I also made a decision to do was the whole kind of structure of supports in the Department of Social Protection were sort of tending more towards, let's say, people staying on social welfare for a long, very long part of the most active part
of
their lives.
Well, that's what the right wing call dependency, isn't it?
No. I see it in a different way. I see it as opportunity. And I don't like the idea that any woman would be simply categorised by virtue of her relationship. If somebody is a parent, they're a parent. To me, their personal relationships shouldn't really be the subject matter for the state. And also, I was always conscious of the fact, as a child and as a deputy and public representative, that occasionally you go into a school, you see a lovely class of four-year-olds or seven-year-olds, and somebody would say, oh, he, she is the child of a lone parent, as though that child would not have the same future as every other child.
Which and is all fine and dandy, but the mother might still like to have more money in her pocket.
Well, hopefully, and the best way, by the way, to do that is for people to get an opportunity to work, to actually have a decent income, and then to have some additional social welfare support, including child benefit allowances. And we do that in this country. But I think it has to be about opportunity. And it also has to be about the children doing well. I mean, in a way,
Exactly. And what I want to do is kind of come back to yourself, because I don't want to, it's not the week of politics, and I don't want to go down that road too much. What did your husband, Pat Carroll, say to you? Because I know you spoke about Bridie and John, you spoke about the families you come from. But this is also a huge partnership in your life and a huge part of who you are.
Well, Pat is the love of my life. I'm very lucky to have a wide range of friends and relatives. I don't see enough of them, but Pat and I are very, very close. And
you talk politics to him. He's the person you talk honestly to.
In the sense that we have had a number of things in common. We both were very involved in the anti-apartheid movement. Both of us would have worked very closely with somebody who went on to be very prominent in South African politics, Kader Asmal, who was a lecturer in Trinity and very involved in a huge amount of organisations in Ireland. And I know when I was appointed a minister, Kader, who used to come over to Ireland twice a year before his untimely death a couple of years ago, just said to me, look, when he became a member of the South African cabinet, that he didn't get the job that he expected or that people expected him to get. And he said, you know what? I said, and I'm saying the same thing to you now, in a few years' time, they'll say, what a fantastic job he did, and nobody expected it. So Kader and I used to kind of have a little
smile for you later on, wasn't it?
A little smile over, you know, politics is, you know, it has its vagaries and its ups and downs. I've seen the hard side of politics. A lot of very good people in the Labour Party lost their council seats and lost their European seats recently. So politics is very human business. So at
do you have friends in politics?
I have friends, and I have people who've supported me from the day I first ran. Some of them were there with me yesterday. And
do you have friends in the cabinet? Do you know, the higher you go, do those friendships, like for instance, Brendan Howland, you called a friend one friend. But then, of course, he got the job in finance and you didn't.
But Brendan and I have been friendly, it seems like, forever. I know many of his family. He knows my family. And the people who work with us know each other. But, you know, most political friendships are business friendships. So it's like the people that you work with and you get on very well. And it's you have to do that. And it's really pleasant to do that. But, you know, they're working relationships. And what I always aim to do is to make the working relationship friendly, cordial, positive. I'm very lucky. I have a small group who work with me as my advisors, Ed and Paul and Karen and the people who work in my office, Elaine and Irene and Pat. They, you know, we're all extremely friendly. They're extremely positive and loyal to me, and they help me enormously. But so also do the friends who advise me about things like my hair or makeup. I think that's the additional dimension in terms of women. Other women are very interested in you as a woman. I suppose the downside of what's developed in politics in recent years, and it's a problem for all the political or for most of the political parties, and that's the kind of trolling stuff that goes on.
Yeah, Mary Beard is on later and talking to us about that, and, you know, classics professor with long grey hair and, you know, cycles about the place, who had huge criticism, and it all got very nasty. A lot of it about her personal appearance.
Yeah, and That on the one hand, there's a kind of a warm, friendly interest that as a woman, for other women, look your best because we want you to do well in this job. I mean, women want women to, as it were, break the glass ceiling, the Chinese walls, the glass walls, whatever you want to call them. And
but to do it with a nice hairdo and a nice dress on
well,
at the same time.
Well, to do it putting your best foot forward so that, first of all, you feel good, that people aren't talking about your appearance. But to obsess about appearance is just completely wrong. And also some of the people who go trolling. I mean, I don't mind much comedians say talking about my voice and that. That's fair game. And but some of the stuff that you see on the internet, and I know a lot of the younger people who've come into the Dáil, both men and women, find some of the withering criticism that leaves no space for any kind of personal acknowledgement that this is another human being. That's a negative, and it's often very difficult for younger women. So I would say that side of politics is a less than happy development. But it's not just Ireland. I was in the UN around the St. Patrick's Day festivities this year when I was in New York, and I chaired a session of women from different parliaments around the world, including women from Islamic countries, where you'd almost say appearance mightn't count that much in the sense that they're generally wrapped in a scarf or a veil. But still, even there. And there was certainly a kind of sensitivity. Mm-hmm. It's fine when it's general stuff. If it goes over a line, it can be very wounding.
But how do you, and actually, we'll play the clip maybe actually before we talk about this. This is the clip because there were times in the Dáil, I mean, and also as a politician, not just as a woman, but as a politician. And, you do tend to talk a lot. And you have the capacity to wind guys up. You have the capacity to wind male politicians up in particular.
Should I say some of my best friends are men?
I wind men up too sometimes. Anyhow, so it's a good thing. But anyhow, here's a very Brian Cowan reacting to you interrupting him, and it was a very famous remark. So let's play the clip and then we'll talk about it.
I'll convey to the deputy what the final arrangements are later on this evening. No, it's no secret. It's just a matter of just...
Deputy Burton, I will call you when it's appropriate, please.
Try and rein her in now and again. I'll apologise for that remark. But I mean, is anyone going to apologise when I get up to speak and people interrupt me all the time? Does anyone apologise? I don't want to make any more issue of that, and I certainly would apologise if anyone took offence, but that's not my intention.
Yes.
But can I just say, there are very few women...
You are not going... Deputy, we're not going to have a lecture from you on this. Will you resume your seat? Deputy, will you resume your seat, please?
Deputy, will you resume your seat? But we were playing that yesterday, just, you know... It sounds so awful, doesn't it, a man saying about a woman... Try and rein her in anyway. He's not even talking to you. He's talking to Eamon Gilmore about you.
And in fairness to Eamon was the stoutest defender of me. I think at the time, quite a lot of people had their mouths hanging open because they couldn't believe that the Taoiseach had said it.
Did it hurt?
Only in the sense that it was a comment on women. It didn't hurt me personally because I had been, let's say, involved in a long debate with Brian Cowan about how the banks were going and in specifically worrying about institutions like Anglo and Irish Nationwide. And there was a bit of a tendency, even though I'm very tall, to kind of pat me on the top of my head and say, like, I'll sit down now, don't be worrying. Your concerns are a bit ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I suppose my take on that was, listen, guys, this is actually really serious. We don't know where we're going. So I resented being patronised. Just in terms of women in general, it just indicated a lack of insight on his part that women would take something. He seemed genuinely surprised that any offence was taken, but you know, he did say, if you're offended, I apologise. And he was big enough to do that. But it certainly means that women just have to, I always think that to go that extra mile, a lot of women who are in public life, whether it's a councillor, whether it's involvement in the officership of a political party, they really have to be that bit better.
All right.
And Kathleen Lynch has had a very good way of putting it. She's often said, I'd love to vote for an ordinary woman as opposed to a spectacular woman. But it always seems to be that we can vote for ordinary men. But when it comes to women, the standards are a lot higher.
There is a point, though, where you do talk, yourself, as you said yourself, you know, beyond the point maybe of benefit. Fergus Finney says today in his open letter to you that, you know, listening isn't your best quality. And there was another incident in the run-up to the last election, and you were on Vincent Brown, and it's a good example maybe of that side of you. Let's play that clip now.
Joan, let him finish what he's saying.
Thank you.
And
will you then let me in? Because Joan doesn't
Joe.
No, I was actually talking to Deputy Simon Coveney here.
Talk away, Mr. Higgins.
The point
would
is...
Would you like to move closer to
the government...
Here you go, you can't stop.
But the point is, we have a government that doesn't have a majority.
What is the point? Get to the point. You're talking for ages.
It's okay. You're going to get a seat. There's room for the two of you in that constituency. It's okay. You don't have to harass them the whole time.
The question is that in the middle of this week...
We have a lot of people on the floor.
Please, Joan, stop.
In the middle of this week, if the government was still in place, you could have brought it down. And then we could have had a debate.
So we leave that exchange there. So is that sexism? Is that Vincent Brown patting you on the head, or is that you just being stroppy?
Well, I don't think I handled that particularly well. On the other hand, it probably was Vincent being Vincent. So I suppose, if you like, two particular people. And I admire Vincent Brown hugely as a journalist. I think he's been one of the best.
And you kind of like a scrap, don't you?
But I think I sort of leave a lot of it to one side nowadays. I think, learned that it might be better just to, as perhaps Fergus Finlay's advice there was very good, to listen more and talk less. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, one of the things that sometimes isn't as strong in Ireland as it ought to be is discussion. And very often, women who get involved in the discussion, if you're as passionate, say, as men are, then that's not passion, it's stridency and all the other stuff that goes with it.
Because there's a lot of people in Fine Gael are afraid that that's what you're going to be like around the cabinet table.
Well, it's not, because I've been 3 years there and... I'm not aware even people who mightn't particularly care for me have ever suggested anything like that. But I do think it's important to give views if you have views and to have discussion. Yeah. I do like to have a discussion. There's an awful lot of people in politics who make the decision first and have the discussion afterwards. I actually welcome the discussion. That probably is a little bit different from the way, in particular, sometimes handlers like to handle things. They like the decision to come down, then the discussion. I like the discussion. I think what's important, and it is a very difficult thing, is to actually have a discussion. Just let's say you're doing some very, very difficult economic decisions, and the government came in at an incredibly awful time in the economic history of Ireland. But I would think that government, whether at the level of a government minister or the whole of the government, is better to try and look as well at the social impact side of the discussion.
And you spoke about this yesterday, about governing with the heart. But the reality is, you know, as Enda Kenny likes to say, there's less than 90 weeks to the next election, if that's presuming everything is stable. And the fact of the matter is, there's a budget to be had in the autumn. Now, you fought like a tiger for your social welfare budget. If you're to turn governing with the heart into anything, you have to fight like a tiger over this budget to make sure there's something in cash on the table that people can say, that's the benefit of the Labour Party being in coalition and the Labour Party being led by Joan Burton. That's a really tall order.
And remember that Fine Gael has similarly committed itself to doing, you know, the best for people, both in terms of their personal
lives. But
their
priorities might be different. Michael Noonan talks about people, couples on 100 grand plus being, you know, struggling to manage. Do you agree with him?
And the other thing as well is a different view of Europe.
But on the families with 100 grand, do you agree?
On the specific kind of family he was talking about the other day was, say, a senior nurse married to a senior Garda who might well have a pre-tax income of over 100,000. But anybody who is familiar with the tax system will know that their after-tax income would be considerably smaller. What a family like that might have if they're, say, 35 to 55, is they may have bought a house at the height of the boom and they may be heavily indebted. So the cash flow, for instance, from payments like child benefit is hugely significant for that family.
So you agree with them, they can be struggling.
Absolutely. And I know people in that situation who bought in confidence or did up a house in confidence, say around 2006, possibly borrowed too much, but then the banks were shoving stuff in the door with every post to say you can borrow more. Whether they made a poor decision or they simply were over-optimistic, overconfident, yes, there are a lot of families like that struggling. There's also a lot of families involved in family businesses, and again, as well as the core business, they may have been involved in a bit of property speculation.
So they might look well off, but in cash terms be struggling.
And
so
the
question is whether
is
you, as a Labour leader now, whether you as Taoiseach and whether this coalition as a government is going to be able to do something that makes those families feel they're a bit better off and is also going to be able to do something that makes people on social welfare feel they're less worse off. And
yes,
an awful lot of economic commentators don't think you'll be able to do that without robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Well, there's two core things to that, and let me give you a simple example. We've a shortage of housing, of social and affordable housing in this country, particularly in our big cities like Dublin and to a lesser extent in Limerick and Cork. We've about 80,000 unemployed construction workers on the live register from the time, many of them from the time of the crash, with only occasional work in between. If we can get an investment programme into housing and we can put a lot of those people back to work, that's going to be one of the best stimuluses that the economy will have received.
Yeah, but you talk about stimulus and the jobs number, and I don't want to get bogged down in an economic debate. It's more a question about the way so many people feel, particularly, you know, the last election was so dreadful for Labour. But one of the reasons was, you know, there's politicians like you and Enda Kenny walking around talking about, you know, the jobs numbers are up, things are, you know, we've turned the corner, things have gone well. But people are looking at their own, you know, household budget and all they see is more and more bills and they're sick of it.
Yeah.
And they're cross with Labour about it.
And that's why I think, you know, for the government in terms of serving out its mandate, which I'm absolutely committed to, and I think it's important.
You won't be cutting and running, no?
I think it's important for the country that we do the job that we took on. But what is important is that we have a programme of tax reform over a number of budgets. It's not going to be possible to do a huge amount on that front in the forthcoming budget. But if we can keep the economy going right, coming back to my own department, every time 10,000 people go back to work, the social protection budget goes down by about 90 million. That means that there's more money to spend on people, perhaps like our pensioners or other people on social protection and targeted. So actually getting people back to work is the secret of cutting public costs.
Let's talk about the Labour Party now. And I know a lot of people in the Labour Party have been saying, you know, it was a great thing that there was a contest and you weren't just a shoo-in. And that's what's been happening, these hustings with you and Alex White going around the country, that was a good thing for the party. And we had Rory Quinn, you know, resigning and taking himself off the stage and Pat Rabbit saying he doesn't want to take up gardening and he very much wants to stay. And you're talking now about Eamon Gilmore and whether, you know, why he'd be such a candidate for the commissioner's job. And maybe that's all just part of trading with Enda on the whole business of, you know, the cabinet reshuffle. But to an awful lot of people watching and listening, it just looks like politicians banging on about politicians and jobs for the boys. And it's a turn off. They don't care about the Labour Party and they wish to goodness they hadn't had to spend the last month hearing all about you all as you do musical chairs.
But in any country, democracy and the institutions of democracy, of which Parliament is one, are just important to people. Now, people, I acknowledge, may get fed up listening. But on the other hand, there was a very, very detailed discussion and debate that in particular involved a lot of the young members of the Labour Party and really forces people to ask questions about where does the Labour Party want to work in terms of Ireland and making Ireland a better place for everybody in Ireland.
But those
and
are fine phrases, like the numbers yesterday, 2,094 versus 607. There's going to be more people watching Antrim play Limerick today. Doesn't that tell you how relevant or even irrelevant the Labour Party is?
No, it tells you that people came to meetings all over Ireland and people watched it being live streamed. This is the first time in Ireland that a party debate for a new leader about the fundamentals of the party was actually played out fully in the media. And I think, you know, at the beginning, a lot of people were very nervous about that. You know, would there be so much anger, so much policy differences that people wanted one thing versus another? But in fact, I think it's been a fantastic exercise in democracy. And it really is a tribute, if you like, to Labour Party people, networks, the Labour movement, that it happened like that.
And you're talking up, that's your job now to talk up that side of the Labour Party. But we're doing, for instance, an item tomorrow on new young councillors. And the Labour Party, when we asked, weren't able to give us anybody under 25. Now, doesn't that tell you the kind of problem you're facing?
Well, on the other hand, we have some very good councillors in their 20s. I'm not sure somebody becoming a councillor when they're 21. I personally, I took a much longer route. I probably had about 10.
You waited till Aoife was in her teens, didn't you?
I took a different route. Well, I did about 10 different jobs. I went and I lived in Africa for 3 years. One of the things that's unique about me in the cabinet is that I've lived and worked abroad. And also I've done a fabulous range of jobs, from working in the city centre in places like Dunn's on temporary jobs, to working as a chartered accountant, to being a lecturer and so on. I certainly personally think that people coming in perhaps, and in fact Alex White has taken the same road, coming in when they've had
experience
careers is also helpful. So maybe you might look at those older, over 25 to 30 Labour councillors, because I can certainly ring lots of them and tell them to give you a shout.
I'll ask you a question that's been asked of Hillary Clinton. I don't know whether it's a sexist question, but I'm asking it again. You're a woman, you know, who walks, she gardens, she swims, she has friends. You know, they wanted you to go to Garth Brooks with them, all that kind of stuff. You're a woman with a life outside politics. You're a woman with a great personal relationship between yourself and Pat. What on earth at the age of 65? I mean, Alex White says you'll only be transitional anyway at that age. What on earth makes you want to take on a job that, you know, is regarded as the toughest job in Irish politics? You could live a nice life instead, Joan.
But you see, in some ways, I've been very privileged to have a journey, that a personal journey in life that's about the most difficult parts of Ireland and Irish society, but also about the best of Irish society. I think it's fantastic that having had, let's say, a less than auspicious start, I can take on this job now. And that's, you know, that's always been with me all my life. When I was in school, Sister Stan was one of the nuns who worked in the convent in Stanhope Street. And
where do you get that drive from?
I don't know. I obviously inherited it possibly from Carlo and Seth Leinster and all that. And I do know that she seems to have been a great gardener. And one of the little lucky things I've always had from the time I was a child is bit of the green fingers. So probably unlike Pat, I'm happy to continuously garden.
And I won't ask you about the reshuffle, but should he start reading the gardening column this weekend? Would that be good advice?
No, I just think gardening is wonderful for everybody. And I think, again, it's something fabulous. I think it's something fabulous we do in Ireland. And Derry, Pat's wife, I think is a great gardener. So he's probably far more knowledgeable than he's letting on, you know.
One final thing. You make a mean cheesecake and you love Jane Austen.
Yeah, I've been a Jane Austen fan forever. I always watch all of the Jane Austen, you know, whether it's Jane Austen in Bollywood or whatever. I love reading. I just don't get the time to do it anymore. For instance, last summer, I was reading and giving to everybody Donald Ryan's The Spinning Heart.
Oh, it's brilliant.
I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a bit in the social welfare office, which I have to say, I was reading on my holidays and laughing out loud. And I was saying, God, this guy must have been a social welfare inspector. I think he works in the public service, but not in social welfare. But he's obviously got amazing insights. It's an amazing set of voices from Ireland during the crisis.
I'm going to finish up. There've been loads and loads of calls in, but I'll finish with this last one, which I think you will like. I wish my mother was alive today to see Joan Burton's appointment as a female leader of a political party. My mother was an ordinary everyday woman whose whole life was affected by Ireland's male hierarchy in church and politics. I bet she and millions of her ilk are raising their glasses up there somewhere in the cosmos. Oh, happy day, sisters. So, Joan Burton,
thank you
on that
much.
Note,
thank
thanks
you.
Very much for coming in to talk
thank
to us.
Thank you, Anya.
The best of luck to you.
Thank
and
you.
It's a tough old gig. Good luck to you. You know it goes downhill from here.
But all I can say is I'll do my best. I'm not, as I think when Michael Healy-Ray was joking last week, that I wasn't Wonder Woman. But I'll do my best. That's all any woman can do, or indeed any man.
Joan Burton, thank you.